We're looking at 1 Timothy 3, 1 to 13, and as it says on the sheet, I've given it the title, Caring for God's Church. One of the surest ways to wreck any organisation is to have the wrong people in leadership and other positions of responsibility. And the same goes for a church. And that is what Paul addresses now. If we just step back a minute from this particular passage, it's clear from the whole of the New Testament that local churches were to be led by groups of elders. Overseers, which is a word that's used in this passage, and elders, it's clear from certain passages, are the same people, the same group are addressed using both titles in some passages. If you like, elder tells us about their status, overseer about their role. It's also clear from the New Testament that local churches could also appoint deacons who were to assist the elders by taking responsibility for certain practical aspects of the life of the church, so that the elders could devote themselves to prayer and the ministry of the word. In this passage, Paul is not setting out the precise roles of elders. If you want to find out about their role, you need to look at passages like the second one that Avian read from Acts 20, which was addressed to elders. Paul is equally not here looking at the precise role of deacons. If you want to know the sort of things that deacons got up to, you need to look at passages like the first one that Avian read from us, from the first few verses of Acts 6. So in this chapter, Paul says virtually nothing about their roles or about how they're chosen. It would seem that in Ephesus, where Timothy is, where Paul's writing to him, telling him what to do, it would seem that there was no particular problem in Ephesus in terms of them having the right structure of leadership or having the right sort of format for elections or appointments or however they did it. But things had still gone wrong in Ephesus because the wrong people had ended up in those roles. And now, because Timothy's effectively been told to go along and remove certain people, now new elders and deacons are to be appointed. So what sort of people should we appoint as elders and deacons? And it's timely for us to be studying this passage because we have a members' meeting a week on Tuesday when we'll be particularly looking at the question of whether there are some other people we could appoint as additional deacons. Very glad with the deacons we've got, feeling it would be helpful if there were other people who could join the diaconate as well. Are there suitable people? So what sort of people should we appoint? And of course, we're always on the lookout for other additional elders if they're suitable people. So I've produced the sheet partly because there are quite a few points I'm going to go through tonight in fairly rapidly, obviously because of the number there are, but also so that you could take it away, because I trust this will be helpful to you prayerfully as we think about this subject together as a church. So let's look firstly at what sort of people should be appointed as elders. So I've got 3 points tonight. The first one is godly elders. Firstly, godly elders, verses 1 to 7. What qualifications should an elder or an overseer have? Now, Paul isn't giving an exhaustive list. He's addressing a particular situation in Ephesus. So he's addressing especially problems that have arisen in the past and saying, well, look, you can't have someone like that. But while the list is not exhaustive, it's certainly extensive. And so I'm not going to go through every qualification, but I want to highlight 5 things, as you can see there. The first thing we learn from this passage and others is that elders must be men. In the last chapter, Dan was preaching on, second half of chapter 2, a fortnight ago, we were taught that women should not be appointed to positions of authority over men in the church. So the church leaders, the elders, should be men. That's been taught in the previous chapter. It's simply assumed here. So when verse 2, for instance, he said, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, he's assuming they're men. He's taking as read. You all understand we're talking about men. If you want to know, and also I suppose in verse 4 as well, he must manage his own household well. Again, it's masculine. If you want to know more about that, then listen to the sermon from a fortnight ago. So that's the first thing. Secondly, elders must have a good reputation with outsiders. It's very striking. There are a list of 15 qualifications here. And the first and the last, so the brackets at the end, are both concerned with the church's reputation before outsiders. Verse 2, it starts with, therefore, an overseer must be above reproach. And it ends, verse 7, with, he must be well thought of by outsiders, so that he may not fall into disgrace, into a snare of the devil. When it says he must be above reproach, that isn't saying he should be perfect, or there would never be any elders in any church. But it's talking about his outwardly observable behavior. Because obviously only God knows his heart. It's saying there mustn't be anything in his outward behavior that people watching would be scandalized about. Because you see, the average decent citizen out there in the world has a very clear idea of what behavior should be expected from leaders. Just think about how people view what politicians get up to. They are scandalized when you have leaders in politics who are, to quote one of the things, points in this passage, lovers of money, when they fiddle their expenses. Now, the people who are scandalized might fiddle their own tax returns and goodness knows what, but they expect better things of their leaders. And equally, people are scandalized when, to cite another recent example, a senior politician mouths off against the police. They may do the same thing themselves, but their leaders shouldn't be violent or quarrelsome, again, quoting the passage. So the backdrop to what Paul's saying here is that as a church, we have a message that we want the world to listen to, the gospel. And we don't want people to say, well, I'm not listening to what they have to say, because have you seen what that church leader gets up to? So we don't want to put stumbling blocks in people's way. We don't want people saying, if that's what Christians are like, I'm not interested. Then thirdly, elders must show tough love. Verses 4 and 5. He must manage his own household well with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? If elders are married men, and they don't have to be, but if they are married men with families, then they are to demonstrate their ability to be church leaders by being leaders at home. And there are two words used here to describe what they're to do in their leadership at home and at church. They are, two words used there in 4 and 5, they are to manage and they are to care. John Stott, as often is the case, explains it well. He says the argument is pretty straightforward. If he cannot look after his own family, he cannot be expected to look after God's. Eli the priest in the Old Testament remains a solemn warning to us, for his sons were both immoral and greedy, but he, quote, in quoting from 1 Samuel 3:13, failed to restrain them. He was a weak leader. The word manage translates a Greek word which combines the concepts of rule and care. This is still John Stott. It indicates that although pastoral ministry is a servant ministry characterized by gentleness, a certain authority also attaches to it. One cannot expect discipline in the local church if pastors have not learned to exercise it in their own home. End of quote. Now we have to recognize that our culture doesn't give fathers the same authority as Roman fathers had. But it still remains true, doesn't it, that if a man who can't be a leader in his own home and can't control his young children clearly isn't suitable to be a church leader. If you think about the way that the media portrays church leaders, typical in fiction particularly, they usually, I think you can sum them up as nice wimps. That is not the Bible's picture. Elders must show tough love. Because as, again, referring to that passage Adrian read earlier, we have to protect the flock against savage wolves. It's not a picnic in the park. Then, fourthly, elders must be self-controlled, verses 2 and 3. Therefore, an elder must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. I think all those things, or most of them, could come easily under the heading of self-control, one of the things in the list. You see, we've just seen that an elder must be somebody who is a strong character. Well, a weak man is controlled by others, but a strong man must control himself. Elders must be self-controlled. In particular, an elder must be under control in his relationships. He must be faithful to his wife. That qualification halfway through verse 2, the husband of one wife. Literally, what the phrase says, he must be a one-woman man. Now, the issue is probably not polygamy. We can see that from chapter 5, verse 9, where it refers to widows being enrolled on the list of widows the church is caring for. And it, amongst the qualifications, she must have been, under 5:9, the wife of one husband. Now, if chapter 3 was forbidding polygamy, that would mean this was forbidding, I think it's called polyandry, having more than one husband. But having more than one husband was totally unknown of in the ancient world. So 5:9 is almost certainly not dealing with that. What it's saying is she must have been a faithful wife. She must have been faithful to her husband. She must have been literally, as it says, a one-man woman. So back in chapter 3, Paul is saying the elder must be a one-woman man. He must be totally faithful to his wife. Now, of course, that rules out polygamy. But it also rules out the man who has only ever had one wife, but is forever flirting with other women. And it rules in the man who was immoral, maybe, and divorced and remarried before he was converted, but has been exemplary in his faithfulness to his wife since his conversion. See, elders must be self-controlled. They must have no obvious weaknesses in the areas of sex or drink or money or temper. See, self-control is real strength. Why on earth Christians like Bond movies, I can never understand. The guy might be macho, but he's a moral wimp. He is a pathetic apology for manhood. Real strength is strength of character and moral fibre. Elders must be self-controlled. Fifthly, elders must be able to teach. Just tucked away in all these things about character, in the middle of verse, end of verse 2, there's this little phrase, able to teach. You know, it's striking. Paul is really focusing on character, but he can't help mentioning the one skill, the one gift that an elder must have. He must be able to teach. It might be from a pulpit. It might be in a small group. It might be one-to-one. But he must be able to teach. Teach the Bible in a way that is profitable to others. John Calvin, writing about 450 years ago, puts it brilliantly. He writes this. He says, "It's not enough for a man to be eminent in profound learning if it is not accompanied by a talent for teaching. There are many who, either because of defective utterance or insufficient mental ability, or because they are not sufficiently in touch with ordinary people, keep their knowledge shut up within themselves. Such people ought to go and do something else." This is Calvin. "Those who are charged with governing the people should be qualified to teach. And what is required here is not merely a voluble tongue, for we see many whose easy fluency contains nothing that can edify. Paul is rather commending wisdom in knowing how to apply God's word to the profit of his people." Absolutely spot on. So much for church leaders, so much for elders. What about the people who assist them by taking responsibility for certain practical areas of church life? Secondly, we look therefore at godly deacons, verses 8 to 13. Firstly, the first thing we can see from this passage is that deacons must be men. In verse 8, Paul starts off talking about deacons, and he does so through clearly to the end of verse 10. Then in verse 11, he changes to talking about some women, and we'll consider who they are later. And then he reverts back to deacons in verse 12, because he starts by saying, let deacons each be the husband of one wife. Like the elders, they must be faithful to their wives. He makes it clear that when he's talking about deacons, he's talking about men. Because he distinguishes carefully what he says about deacons from what he says about these women in verse 11. Whoever they are, whoever these women are in verse 11, and we'll look at that in a minute, Paul makes it clear they're not deacons. So deacons must be men. Secondly, deacons must be of excellent character also, but I think it's noticeable that the standard laid down is not as searching as that for an elder. Verse 8, deacons must be dignified, not double-minded, not addicted to much wine, not greedy for dishonest gain. Back in Acts 6:3, it says the men who were to be appointed, were almost certainly a deacon role, had to be men of good repute. So again, the deacons must be men who won't bring the church into disrepute. They mustn't be people who are saying, my goodness, I wouldn't go near that church. They've appointed so-and-so as the treasurer, and oh my goodness, he fiddled the books. You can't point people like that. And they must be, again, men who have an exemplary home life. Verse 12, deacons each be the husband of one wife, managing their children and their own households well. But it's noticeable that the list isn't as exhaustive as that for elders. So it's as though Paul is saying, look, we're again seeking men of excellent character, good reputation, no obvious weaknesses, they mustn't be addicted to much wine. But the bar isn't, if I put it like this, isn't quite as high as the bar for elders. Then thirdly, deacons must not be two-faced. Verse 8, this interesting phrase, this unique to the deacons. Deacons likewise must be dignified, not double-tongued. I think it's great that our translation gives a very literal translation here. It literally does say two-tongued. What he's saying is they mustn't be the sort of person who says one thing to one person and then something different to someone else. And this is so relevant because I think it identifies a particular temptation for a deacon. If you're an elder, you're always sort of one of the leaders who's addressing the congregation in a sense. But deacons are in some ways placed between the elders and the congregation. They are there to assist the elders by serving the congregation. And so there's more of a temptation for them to play for different audiences. To when they're meeting with the elders, oh yes, yes, I agree with that, yes, that's quite right. But when they're meeting with the congregation and someone complains about, oh yes, I agree, the elders haven't got that right, have they? You know, to play for different audiences. So what Paul is really saying is deacons must be men of sufficient moral strength to resist that temptation and therefore to show integrity in dealing with people. They mustn't be two-faced, two-tongued. Then, fourthly, deacons must show integrity with money. Says the end of verse 8, not greedy for dishonest gain. You see, your deacons, you're putting in positions where they are taking responsibility for practical aspects of the church life. So, very often, they're administering money. Think of the original deacons in Acts 6. They must have been given substantial resources to look after the feeding of the widows. They must be trustworthy in that area. Now, there are some Christians out there who are undoubtedly saved, but look, they have a weakness in that area. Whatever you do, don't appoint them as deacons. Then fifthly, deacons must be sound doctrinally. Verse 9, they must hold the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. Think of it like this. Say a man is converted, and he has incredible practical skills. or is fantastic administratively. And that'd be a great temptation. Oh, this is an answer to prayer. This is just, we're desperate for more deacons. Oh, must appoint Mr. So-and-so as a deacon. Okay, he's very young. He has got a very flimsy grasp of Christian doctrine. He's come from a church background where he's got some pretty hairy ideas. But oh, who cares? We're asking him to look after the building. We're not asking him to preach. No, that's wrong. Any position of responsibility in a local church must be occupied by those who are sound in their doctrine, who've got a good grasp of Christian beliefs. Because you see, the reality is that everything we do is shaped by what we believe. And if a man has got some area where he's really, you know, off the wall in terms of his doctrine, it will come out when you give him practical responsibilities. So deacons must be sound doctrinally, even if their particular responsibilities are practical. And then sixthly and finally, under this second point, deacons should be tested. Deacons should be tested. Verse 10. And let them also be tested first, then let them serve as deacons if they prove themselves blameless. Now, why does Paul say that? Well, Paul has already counseled back in verse 6, it's one of the verses I didn't really look at in detail, against rushing in when you appoint elders. He says, verse 6, he must not be a recent convert, or he might get proud. He's saying if you're appointing an elder, well, look, don't rush in. Give the man time to grow and to mature. Because anyway, you see, it takes time for it to become evident what a person's character is like. There's some great verses at the end of chapter 5. You turn over to chapter 5, verse 22, end of chapter 5. Do not be hasty in the laying on of hands, nor take part in the sins of others. And then verse 24, the sins of some men are conspicuous, going before them to judgment, but the sins of others appear later. So also good works are conspicuous, and even those that are not cannot remain hidden. You know, what he's saying there is, given enough time, it will become evident what someone's character is like. Hence, you don't rush. But with deacons, I think what Paul is saying here is, look, we don't need to wait quite as long as you would for an elder to see how he turns out. But instead, what he's saying is an alternative. Give him a sort of probationary period. You know, okay, we'll appoint him, but we'll have a year on probation. Let's see how he goes. And then appoint on a permanent basis when they've passed that period. And deacons should be respected, verse 13. For those who serve well as deacons gain a good standing for themselves and also great confidence in the faith that is in Christ Jesus. Why does Paul add that? Well, Paul was writing and living in a culture where manual labour was looked down on. And he's saying, look, we mustn't bring that attitude into the church. Just because you're appointing a man to do a practical job, you mustn't think he's somehow inferior to someone who's doing an intellectual job, as it were. Well, that's the world's values. That mustn't come into the church. Deacons are not sort of just, hey, you people for the church. Hey, you can come and do this. They've got different gifts to the elders, but their service is just as valued by the Lord, and they should be just as valued by the church. Now, as we close, what about the women in verse 11? Well, thirdly and finally, godly elders and deacons must have godly wives. Two facts when we look at verse 11 we need to get straight at the beginning is that, firstly, there is no word for there in the original text. And secondly, the word for wife in Greek, unfortunately for us, is exactly the same as the word for women. So there is that opening phrase in verse 11, which our translation translated their wives, is literally either the women or the wives. It could be either. Is it we're referring to the wives of the deacons, perhaps also the wives of the elders? Or is it referring to a separate group of women who held some post in the church, who perhaps served alongside the deacons in some way? Simple conclusion is that we can't be certain. The more you read up on it, the more you read that nobody knows definitely for certain. If I had to plump for one or the other, I think it probably refers to the wives of the elders and deacons and not some separate group of women who were appointed to assist the deacons in some way. The reason for that is that in this letter, every group who are appointed to some particular position have as a qualification that they must have been faithful husbands or faithful wives. That applies to the elders, it applies to the deacons, it applies to the women, the widows in chapter 5. So one would expect that if this was referring to a separate office, of sort of women helpers, then it would also have a qualification about them being faithful to their husbands. The fact that it doesn't, I think, fits more with the fact that he's referring to wives. He's not talking about appointing them. It's just part of the qualification for their husbands is that their wives must be godly. Now, as I say, that's tentative. That I may be wrong in that. What we can say for certain is that women certainly are to serve in the church, and the ways they serve are just as valuable to God as the ways men serve. The church is not a status-conscious body. That is all wrong. We are all servants of God. No more, no less. Whatever position we hold in the church. Seems to me a lot of the sort of feminist, so-called evangelical feminist agenda has been motivated by being over status conscious, that we should open up the highest offices to women. Well, hang on a minute, that's worldly thinking. Everyone who serves in the church is a servant. We're not status conscious body. We've just got different roles. And we know also from chapter 2 that women shouldn't be appointed to positions of authority over men in the church. And that is what we see, interestingly, worked out in the next generation. After the apostles had died, we've got a fair bit of evidence about what went on in the early church, and someone summed it up that women were appointed to positions of responsibility, and their duties were, I quote, quite varied. They taught children and youth, evangelized unbelieving women, discipled new believers, visited the sick, cared for the ailing, administered communion to shut-ins. In the worship service, they served as doorkeepers, assisted with the baptism of women, and administered communion as the occasion arose, end of quote. So women should serve, but not in positions of authority over men. But if we take this verse as referring to the wives of elders and deacons, what it reminds us is that a man's suitability for leadership or any other position of responsibility depends also on his wife. Their wives likewise must be dignified, not slanderous, but sober-minded, faithful in all things. Sadly, there have been men who in many respects have been good church leaders, but they've been fatally undermined in their ministry by their wives. So when you're appointing someone, don't just consider him, consider his wife also. But to sum up, what this passage is saying is we need to keep the gospel in focus. We want elders and deacons who live out the gospel. We want wives who support them in that. We want people who have a good reputation before the outside world so that the world will listen and respect the church and listen to its message. Let's pray.